It's been 5 years since I talked to you, and 5 years since I read Copeland, 1900 through 1942. I wonder, just for my benefit, to refresh my mind and to help our listeners, could you just give me a little capsule background about Copeland through his first 42 years? I know he was born over the family department store in Brooklyn.
Yes.
We start there.
Yes,
do this in a kind of a small way.
His father owned a Copeland's department store, which was called the Macy's of Brooklyn and was a thriving business, and the family lived above and to the side of the store, and Copeland grew up in the business world and with very little contact with the music world or, in fact, the art world in any way. His frequently has been asked through the years where his talent came from, and he had no answer for that, as you can imagine. And he had a sister who was studying piano, and a brother who played the violin a little bit, and he learned what he could from them, and then when he began to take lessons, as his parents agreed that he could, his teachers felt that he had special talent. And the big change when people began to take Copeland seriously is when, as a teenager, he crossed the Brooklyn Bridge to Manhattan and took lessons with a famous teacher in Manhattan, Reuben Goldmark. And it was at that time that formulated his decision to spend his life in music, and in fact that his family and other people felt knew that he had some talent. He had never been outside of New York or Brooklyn until he left for Paris in 1921, at the age of 20, going on 21. And that happened because he had a close friend who told him about the great happenings in the art world in Paris, and of course he himself by that time knew that that's where the action was in music and the other arts, and he was absolutely determined that he would go and study in France. An interesting thing happened there. He had a distant cousin whose name was Harold Clurman, a very well-known name in the theater world, one of our great theater directors, and they were two kids, and they went together, Clurman to study theater and literature, and Copeland to soak in the scene, you know, of the and to see where he might study. Frequently, and even in the standard books on music, it's claimed that Copeland went to France to study with the famous Nadia Boulanger. He didn't go, even knowing the name, not only not knowing her, nor was she famous then. He found her at Fontainebleau in the summer of 1921, and someone said, "You must go and see how this woman teaches," and he sensed something there. And she was 34 at that time, and was not the famous teacher that she's viewed and historically now. When Copeland went back to Paris after the summer, having learned some French, and he went with the decision then to study with Nadia Boulanger. One of his famous stories is that he didn't know how to tell people, the folks back at home, because he could think of not one single famous composer who had ever studied with a woman. And his way of handling that, since the family was very practical minded, was that it would cost a little less than the person that he perhaps had thought of studying with. I'd say the 3 years in Paris, he went with the idea of going for a year, and he stayed for three. And he studied during that entire time with Boulanger, and to this day, he, if a time in his life he would need to choose one period of time, as perhaps other people might say their college years, he has felt about those 3 years in Paris, that they were the most exciting, the most wonderful, and the most meaningful in the formative years, his maturing as a composer. He came back to New York in 1924, and he didn't know anything about the music world. He didn't know anything that was happening in New York, but Boulanger had introduced him to Serge Koussevitzky in Paris. Again, Copland is fond of saying that he was a lucky guy, and in fact he was lucky. Because Koussevitzky, in 1924, had assumed the position, taken the position as music director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And it was exactly coincidental to when Aaron Copland arrived back from Paris. And so Copland came back with a commission to write a work to be performed for two people, Walter Damrosch and the New York Symphony, because of Boulanger was coming to premiere that work, and for it to be played by Koussevitzky and the Boston Symphony.
What was the name of that work?
The work was a symphony for organ and orchestra.
That was his first major piece?
That's right, yes. And he had never heard a note of his own orchestration. And the first time he did hear anything was when Damrosch was conducting a rehearsal of the New York, what was then called the New York Symphony. Damrosch was not very, he had taken Copland the commission, the idea, because of Boulanger. He was not really interested, and in fact stepped in before the audience, and when that work was premiered, and said, "If a young man, 24, can write a work like this, at 25 he could commit murder." And the next day in the papers it said, "Composer to commit murder," and it's been a famous story in the music world, of course. But Koussevitzky was a different story. He was seriously interested in Copland as a composer, and it was when Copland would be asked who were the most meaningful people in his lives, he would point to Boulanger as his teacher and Koussevitzky as his mentor, and the person who helped him the most in his career by giving him the confidence to, again, giving him the opportunity to have his first works played by an orchestra like the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and a great conductor championing him, and the critics lambasting everything and saying it was terrible sounds, and it's hard for us to say. Copland for a long time has been a familiar territory for most people, and it bears reminding that he was once called the wild-eyed modernist, and that he
His earlier works were rather derivative, weren't they? They sound much like the early Gershwin.
Well, you're right in that, because they're jazz-oriented, and that Symphony for Organ and Orchestra had a little jazz, but the next work, Music for the Theater, that Koussevitzky premiered, was overtly jazz-oriented and really quoted jazz materials, as Gershwin's works of the same time. This is, we're talking about the 20s. Jazz was the big thing in the 20s. But the major thing for Copland then was that he had made the conscious decision to try to find an American sound. And that happened while he was in France. He realized that there was, didn't want to be an expatriate, that there was a French-sounding music and a German-sounding music. And so when he came back to the States, he made that decision that he wanted to try to find an American sound. And the easiest, fastest way to do that at first was jazz-oriented work. So yes, you're right. They do sound derivative, and the major works of the 20s, the first few big works of the 20s, even so, they caused a scandal. Anything, I mean, the idea of jazz in the concert hall, especially in Boston, was shocking. And Koussevitzky just thought that was part of the fun, in a way, part of the challenge.
And in fact, classical music draws on almost every source, doesn't it?
Yes.
Whether it's jazz or folk music.
Yeah.
I always wondered how composers survived financially, and it's apparent that Copland did through the method of accepting commissions. But
yes.
How does one get commissions, and who commissions a composer?
Well, those early works, of course, he didn't have commissions, and young composers don't have commissions. They in the Copland's day, they had a wonderful thing. It's called patrons and patronesses, who were interested in concert music, and if a young person was considered as Copland was, a talented young foremost person on the scene that needed some help, they would then go to an Alma Wertheim or one of the well-known patrons or patronesses, and they would be given some funds to live on. These days, there are grants and NEA prizes and awards, and young composers and composers really have to teach, and Copland had to do that too. He taught at the New School in his early years, and that's in the first volume, the story about his teaching at the New School. Series of lectures that then became his first book, What to Listen For in Music, which has fairly recently been reprinted and has done extremely well through the years. And so, in fact, though, what young composers do is struggle. They always have, and they still do, and until they reach the point where they are given commissions, or more of them are available now than they were in Copland's day. And there are more composers now.
Now, through the 30s, Copland had built on his reputation and began to score movies. And he scored some movies that were really well known. Can you tell me about that? And in
yes.
fact, in 1942 or 43, where you open the next volume, Copland is indeed in Hollywood.
That's
right.
A little
bit about his Hollywood experience.
Yes. He had already composed music for two very successful films by the time 1943 rolled around, and those familiar ones are Mice and Men and Our Town. And again, it's surprising with Copland. He had very little experience of writing for films. He wrote one documentary called The City that had to do with New York City because he needed some credit before he went to Hollywood. And then he did the scores for Of Mice and Men and Our Town. And those were very successful films in the 40s, in the early 40s. So by the time the second volume of his autobiography, Copland Since 1943, begins, it was wartime. There was very little Copland could do. He felt frustrated because he was 43 years old, past age where he could be in the service. He wanted to do whatever he could that was patriotic, and he had the opportunity to compose the music for a film called The North Star, Samuel Goldwyn's to be his biggest production, with a wonderful cast and a script by Lillian Hellman, which meant a great deal to Copland. He admired her, and it was about Russia. and it was pro-Russian, very, very pro-Russian.
I tape recorded that from, I think, Channel 13 a while ago and saw for the first time, what propaganda.
Yes.
Really propaganda. I mean, it was a great film. I mean, it served our purposes just fine, but what propaganda.
And
slap you in the face.
And wrote everything from balalaikas to, very interesting because that score is not very well known, but he did a similar kind of thing in that as he did with El Salam Mexico, and as he did with Billy the Kid and Rodeo, where he could use cowboy tunes in those cowboy ballets and Mexican tunes, he adapted Russian-sounding folk music for the North Star, and all kinds of Russian-sounding folk music. Were you pointing out the fact that you could see that? You see it now, late-night television, under a different title called, it's called Armored Attack. And just when the film came out, Russia became our enemy rather than our ally. And poor Samuel Goldwyn had this film that was a help Russia propaganda film and no place for it to go. So it was a real flop.
It's amazing in the book that you point out, or Copeland points out, that he got the Russian music wrong. I mean, he had Russian-sounding music, but there were regional differences in
That's
music.
Right.
It's like using a New England sea shanty and using it as part of a Western.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was very amused by that. It was when Lillian Hellman came back from Russia, they pointed that out to her there. So, in fact, the North Star is interesting and good. It was an interesting experience. It took quite a long time for Copeland to do that film. Was certainly not a successful film. It didn't become a suite as the Art Town music and Music from Of Mice and Men are included in something called Music for the Movies. But then later in the 40s, Copeland did what is perhaps his most well-known score, and that is The Heiress, well-known because he won an Oscar for that. And that sits in the same place in his house. It's always been in an alcove. I'm used to seeing it there, and he's always been proud of that.
And now, Vivian, we only have about 20 minutes and a lot of ground to cover, so we're going to have to do some skipping. But in 1943, he wrote one of his best-known small compositions, Fanfare for the Common Man. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, and that's a wartime piece, and it was commissioned for a series of fanfares that Eugene Goossens was doing with the Cincinnati Orchestra, and he wanted a patriotic thing at the beginning of every one of his concerts, and Copeland thought he was doing a short piece that would be heard once at this one particular occasion. Really had very little idea that was going to go any further than that one-shot piece that he was doing as a patriotic, really patriotic gesture. And he couldn't think of a name. He had music for soldiers and sailors, fanfare for the armed forces, fanfare for Lidice, the little town in Czechoslovakia, the fanfare for this and that. And some of those names are on his score, sketches of his score. It's hard for us to think of that music as anything but Fanfare for the Common Man. And it was a wonderful title.
Wasn't that also used as the basis for his Third Symphony?
He includes it in the Third Symphony, the final movement. Copeland frequently used his material in different ways.
And was criticized for that, too.
Sometimes was criticized for that,
for imitating himself.
That's right, plagiarizing himself. But
if that's possible.
Again, he was always practical-minded and never felt that he was doing it. He felt that the material, he didn't know that Fanfare for the Common Man would be heard so much. And he felt that that was good material and that he would like to use it so that it would be heard more. And The very well-known Third Symphony, his great Third Symphony, was an end-of-the-war piece and was to be jubilant, and it was something that Koussevitzky was premiering, and he, the Fanfare for the Common Man material in the fourth movement was just right, you know, for the kind of feeling that he wanted.
Now, his best-known work is probably Appalachian Spring, but there's a very interesting story, because I don't think Copland realized he was doing Appalachian Spring when he did it. And tell me about the Martha Graham story.
Copland always wanted to work with Martha Graham. He had a way of knowing the right people to collaborate with, as much as he would say he was lucky about getting together with them. There was a sense of selectivity there, and he knew that he wanted to work with her. They had worked, she had used pieces of music for a ballet earlier, and when she asked him for music for a ballet in 1944, it was premiered in 45, he readily agreed. He was very, very much wanted to work with her. She sent him various scripts, and he only knew the outline of this, of what she wanted. And they didn't see very much of each other. There were many delays. The work was to be a premiere at the Coolidge Auditorium in Washington. Mrs. Elizabeth Sprague Coolidge, who was one of the patrons of the arts, had commissioned three new ballets. Copland finished the piece, sent piano recordings of it off to Martha Graham, and went to Mexico to work on his Third Symphony. And when he came to Washington, he had not heard any of the, he hadn't heard the, seen any of the ballet at all. And Martha Graham, at rehearsal, said, he said to Martha Graham, what have you decided to call this piece? He had named it Ballet for Martha. And she said, Appalachian Spring. And he said, oh, how nice. Why? What does that have to do with? Where did you get that title? And she said, well, it is from a poem from Hart Crane. And he said, does it have anything to do with your ballet? And she said, no, I just like the sound of it. And that was the day before the premiere. And he's very fond of telling the story about how people have come up to him, many, many people after a concert of Appalachian Spring, and said, oh, Mr. Copland, I can just smell the Appalachians and I can just feel spring in your music. And even when he tells them the story that he didn't have that in mind, they still feel that way.
Also, the Hart Crane poem had nothing to do with the seasons. It was about,
no, it didn't.
And about literally a spring,
well,
about
I'm,
a pond.
I'm proud of that, because that's a bit of my own research. The story had been around for a long time, and I decided to go to the Yale Library, where I'm on the faculty there, and find the Hart Crane poems and find that line. And to my great surprise, and to many other people's, the line had to do with a waterfall. The spring of this the Appalachian Spring was a waterfall in the Hart Crane poem, and not springtime.
And we're going to have to do some skipping here, because I only have 15 minutes, and I have to go on elsewhere. But I think in the 1950s, this is one of the most interesting chapters, where Copland was linked to the Communist Party and was even called before Senator Joe McCarthy's hearings. Now, was Copland ever a communist?
No. He was not only was he not a communist, he was a very apolitical figure. He had very little interest in politics as such, but he had friends who were and then many people in the 30s was a mark of pride, especially among artistic and intellectual New Yorkers and other people in the arts, to be socialists and to be involved with socialism. And don't forget also that Copland's involvement with Koussevitzky, he never wanted to refuse Koussevitzky, who supported, who wanted to support Russian war relief and Russian causes, and Copeland would always agree to be on whatever committee or to be on. So in fact, he had many affiliations, Russian affiliations, through Kusvitsky. No, he was never active politically at all. And the feeling was that McCarthy was after big names, and Copeland was a big name in music. And so that
McCarthy
was
McCarthy actually dragged Copeland down to Washington.
Well, the telegram arrived, that fearful telegram, and it was preceded by the cancellation of Lincoln Portrait at the Eisenhower inauguration in 1952. And so Copeland was not totally surprised that McCarthy, to be called in front of the HUAC committee, because it was preceded by precipitous cancellation of all things Lincoln Portrait for the inauguration.
But Life magazine published his picture describing him and a number of others as a dupe and a fellow traveler.
That's right.
Isn't that grounds for libel or slander or something?
Well, if you see the page with the people, Copeland's picture between Leonard Bernstein and Clifford Odets, I think, are the two flanking him. But somebody did point out at the time that the people that Life magazine called dupes and fellow travelers were the cream of American arts and letters. And so it would have taken this is the kind of persecution that people were subjected to during the McCarthy, and that this country allowed to happen, where suing for slander would have been an admission of guilt, and it was a very bad situation.
Those are terrible, terrible times. Copeland, in the book, talks about, is asked why our comments upon, let me sort this out a little more coherently. He has been asked about why there are few, if any, Jewish themes in his music. Copeland, of course, is Jewish, and he has responded to that. Can you tell me briefly how he reacts to questions like that?
Yes, he used very little. He used some traditional Jewish material, and he has one piece called Vitebsk, which is a trio, and it's based on a theme from the Divok. And but for the most part, he had always felt that that composer had to do his own music from his own experience, and he had felt that whatever Jewishness is in him is in his music in a subtle way. And in fact, sometimes there are qualities in his music that people have pointed to without them being actual theme, Jewish, labeled with Jewish titles or Jewish themes. There's a certain kind of declamation and a kind of quality to his music that Virgil Thompson, for example, pointed to as Jewish. But Copeland was really not interested in pursuing that kind of material, and felt that if that did not come from a genuine musical interest, that almost everything he wrote was or chose to write was stem from musical ideas. And his and then he would frequently say that the fact that he grew up in a Jewish tradition, which was important to him and important to his family, and he never negated in any way, that he was more interested in other areas than what was most familiar to him. He had a very lively curiosity about all kinds of other things in life.
Now, with regard to his personal life, Copeland seems reticent, even during the periods where he himself is speaking in the biography. And sometimes I want to know more about him. For example, all through the book, a young man named Victor Kraft pops up. And it's obvious, Copeland never married, and I would assume that he was part of a homosexual community. But this is not made clear, of course, and it's never directly addressed. But I have the feeling that he had a long term intimate relationship with Victor Kraft. Are you in a position to discuss that?
Yes, your feeling is absolutely right. And in fact, your impression that you have voiced is exactly the way Copeland led his life. He would not have made direct statements about sex or sexuality and so forth, but nor would he have hidden the fact that Victor Kraft was his intimate friend, and that they lived together, and that he is a homosexual. But I think we need to remember that Copeland is about to be 90. He comes from a different time than before the sexual revolution, and his own personality is one that is very private, reticent, gentlemanly, careful about his. He would not have talked about anyone's private life any more than he would his own. So on one hand, without trying to hide anything about himself, he would not have spoken freely and openly. And this being a co-authored and essentially his autobiography, of course, the most important thing is that it represent Copeland as the man that he is. And
but when Victor Kraft died, Copeland mentions it in less than a paragraph. And here was a man who was almost not a lifelong companion, but a long time companion.
That's true.
And Copeland almost dismisses it. Mm-hmm. When Copeland's brother committed suicide, Copeland makes reference to his brother in three sentences.
Yes.
So I don't know what kind of relationship he had with his family. There are photographs with his nephews and nieces in this.
That's true. Well, he was reticent about his personal life, and it's one of the reasons that I tried to include many interviews with people who could address some of these things a little more directly. I think of Ned Roram, for example, and his interview.
That was the most explicit,
I think.
Ned Roram, the young composer, really got to the nitty-gritty of Copeland's life more than almost anybody else.
Yes, and
addresses him.
And he feels that it's not fair to Copeland for people to treat him as though he had no normal private life. And there are other things, though, about Copeland and his private life that come into play there. And he was always a kind of person. He was always a kind of person who did keep these things to himself. It's not only in his book. You have some young composer friends describing when his favorite sister died. He excused himself. People were visiting Copeland, and he went to her funeral and came back and seemed to be somewhat quiet and maybe had a headache or something. And the next day they found out that he had been at her funeral. He never wanted to impose his feelings, especially if they were ones of distress in any way, on anyone else. And that included on people close to him. So it isn't just that material doesn't come in his book. It's the way he has handled his life.
Well, you worked with Copeland for some 10 years on this
project,
didn't you? Did he put any limits on you as to what could be expressed in this book?
No, not at all. He has a way of, I sensed with working with him, the kind of collaboration I think that other people did who worked with him on other works, an enormous confidence that he has once he has decided that someone is the right person. Never any question, always listened very, very carefully to anything I would say, whether he a little reluctant to include as much of the McCarthy business, because he's a very optimistic person, very not wanting to dwell on anything that was unpleasant, not wanting to hide it, but feeling, well, this isn't musical material, you know, why would it be? But he would always listen to me, and I can't think of a time where he disagreed when I felt something should be included or expanded. On the other hand, I think I would not have been the person to work with him if I myself had been intrusive or pressuring him in any way to be something or to speak about something that he would not feel comfortable with.
Some of the most interesting material is yours, and these are the interludes, especially toward the end where you describe his, how he works and his study and this sort of thing. I thought that was absolutely fascinating because that got me closer to a man who deliberately kept himself aloof. I mean, for example, he would say, I conducted this concert, and I went to Mexico here, and I there was a party for me here, but I wanted to know more about how he felt. And maybe that's not fair, though. I mean, there are reticent people. I'm like that. I mean, very few. I rather rarely tell anybody exactly the way I feel. And so you hate to tread on someone's privacy.
And famous people are expected somehow to divulge secrets, and people today really look for exposés and scandals and disasters. And in fact, they're very interesting to read about all those things. But if what you're after is a true picture of a person, this is the way Copeland was and is. And and I think he says something very telling in the end, that little section that I put together, reflections on a life in music from some of the things he had said, important things he had said, and that is that the place where where he could feel open and honest and bearing his soul, so to speak, is in his music, and I feel very grateful for that myself.
He gave you a fair degree of access to his papers, I would assume. You have so many photographs and sheet music and letters.
It has been an enormous help to me, and his generosity and confidence in just a lot. I mean, I had absolute free range to be able to go to the house and to go into the correspondence collections, into the photographic collection. He saved everything. And it's all going to the Library of Congress so that future biographers and historians will have use of this very rich material. It is certainly an enormous help to me.
Did he have fun working on this with you?
Yes.
Or was it a pain?
Yes. No. He's a very fun-loving person, absolutely enjoys life, and is one of the reasons that he doesn't like to dwell on these. He would say, agonizing is not my thing. He really would like to move on to something enjoyable, and sunny and optimistic, cheerful kind of a person. And it was a pleasure to work there because it was always fun.
Have you been able to maintain a social relationship with him? Do you still see him?
Oh, yes. Yes.
So it wasn't just pure business and the project is over and that's it?
No. I just remember I spent a great deal of time interviewing him for the oral history project that I direct at Yale School of Music, and those interviews were done back in 75 and 76, and they took quite a bit of time, and there would always be social time involved with, you know, a few hours of work and then a wonderful break for always a delightful lunch, and other people would come to visit, and it would be stories about the music world and gossip about music people, and he would have the wonderful time.
Yeah,
and
I
laughter.
Mentioned that he likes to gossip.
Yes,
he likes to talk about things.
And a wonderful laugh and a famous giggle and then he would, lunch would be over and he would always say, au travail, you know, and we'd all go back to work. For a little while, he and perhaps an assistant who would work on some correspondence, I'd always be bringing things up from the basement, sketch material and so forth, to show him that would maybe remind him of something he might have forgotten, and it was great pleasure.
Well, Vivian, I have several pages of questions here I was going to get to, but
I think
I'm going to have to let somebody.
My enthusiasm is such that I'm afraid I get started. It's hard to speak about some of these things in a few sentences. So,
well,
I hope, I know you'll have more than enough.
We've covered quite a bit of ground in these 45 minutes.
Oh, yes. So, certainly did.
I really enjoyed reading this book. It was a yeoman's effort, and
yeah,
it's a terrific job. Thank you very much.
Thank you.